My plan for today is to introduce the issue of the critical historical study of halakha, talk about it a little bit, teach a tshuva, teach a medieval rabbinic responsum that I think is a curious text, a very interesting text, and then open everything up for discussion. So that's the plan for today. I guess to begin the talk, I'd like to set up two possible models, neither one of which is my favorite model for looking at the history of halachic literature. Rabbi J. David Bleichen, in the introduction to one of his volumes, talks about how psak halacha is a science and not an art, and you know. I was thinking of bringing in the passage and going through it phrase by phrase and showing how I disagreed with him, and I decided that was a little bit too much to do to somebody whom I do respect quite a bit. But the impression that was created in this text is that there are halachic facts that are put into the mind of a halachic decisor, and there is one answer that can come out. It is clear that there is one conclusion that one could reach. As long as all the facts are put in, there will be one answer that will come out. That's model number one. That's not precisely the model that I like. Model number two, which is also a model that I don't like, is the... I have respect for both of the people who have these kinds of models. Model number two is the model of Lou Greenberg, who is... famous for the declaration, if there is a rabbinic will, there is a halachic way. That if the rabbis want to do something, they can do it. That there is no limit to what the rabbis can do. I was told recently that some wag has figured out how to say that in Hebrew, that the proper translation into Hebrew of if there is a rabbinic will, there is a halachic way is Im tirtzu, ein zo halacha. If you wish, it is not halacha. And as long as the rabbis want it not to be halacha, then it won't be halacha. The question is just how legitimate is it when we? I assume that a lot of people will want to deal with the question. I'm open to dealing with this question later on in the discussion. What are the ramifications? If you do use a critical historical attitude towards halakha, what does that mean for halachic observance? And I'm willing to get there, but that's not that's not my primary goal of where to get to today. But the question is it legitimate? Is there a historical basis for analyzing halakha and saying that Rabbi X said so-and-so because, that's who that rabbi is, and he's likely to do that, or because there's a specific historical situation in which he lived that obtained in his period and that does not obtain anymore right now. Maybe just give a little cover to a great Gadol who died this week, of Eliezer Waldenberg, the author of the Tzitz Eliezer. Some of you might be on the same email list that I'm on. Somebody sent out this week, in honor of the passing of Rabbi Waldenberg, sent around the Wikipedia article about Rabbi Waldenberg. So it was actually a rather interesting article. But there was one little kind of snide comment. You know how everybody knows how Wikipedia works. Anybody can change it. Anybody can add to it. Anybody can say anything that they wanted to. Rabbi Waldenberg had a wonderful responsum in which he said that a deaf person can wear an electronic hearing aid on Shabbat and that there's no problem with it. And there were quotations from this tshuva in the Wikipedia article, but the lead-in sentence was something like, unlike most halachic decisors Rabbi Waldenberg took very seriously the principle of kibbutz habriyot, the dignity of human beings, as we see in this responsive. So, you know, just dissing of all the other halachic decide. I would have loved to have seen a footnote to prove that, you know, that Rabbi Waldenberg did care about kibbutz habriyot, and that other halachic decisors don't care about kibbutz habriyot. But that's the person who wrote this article, I think, was trying to create the impression that Rabbi Waldenberg, because he was the kind of person who had a respectful attitude towards other human beings, so that's why he wrote a responsa like the responsa that he wrote. And other rabbis don't. Pardon me? Right. It's not a big thing. Yes, yes. I think that, you know, most seriously, right, from people that I know who need to wear hearing aids on Shabbat. So yes, it's not such a big chidush. But it was interesting to see Rabbi Waldenberg trotting out the argument of kibbutz habriyot as a central piece in his argumentation. So those are the two models that I wish to avoid. The one that says that halachic decisizing is a science and that you're always going to come up with a clear conclusion on a subject, and the model that says that the rabbis can say anything. Now those are the two easier, intellectually, those are the two easier models to relate to. You know, the radical models are easier models to kind of relate to, and the nuanced model in the middle that I'm perhaps going to be suggesting today is not the easiest one to suggest. But I will, I'll put it forward anyways. First of all, I would like to argue, the first point that I would like to try to make is that obviously you have to suggest that halachic texts are the result of a society in which they were created, and that the Rambam felt absolutely no problem about suggesting that about the Torah, that the Torah is the product of the society in which the Torah was written and is better understood by people who live in the time that the Torah was written than understood by us, and that relates to concerns that are no longer part of the world that we live in right now. And if Rambam feels that it's legitimate to say that about the Torah, then, you know, kol vachomer, you're allowed to say this about Abaye and Rava, or about the Rambam, that he was relating to a specific historical situation that existed in his time. And here are just a couple of well-known examples of texts from the Rambam where he says this. Everyone has a copy of the text. I used the English translation of the Guide of the Perplexed that is available for free on the internet, which is the old Friedlander translation, which I think from 1919, and so the copyright has run out on it, so it's legal to just use your mouse to copy out the text from the internet and put it here. But the English is not precisely the English that I would have used. Most of the statutes, and of course the reason that it's in English here instead of Hebrew is because it wasn't written in Hebrew, it was written in Judeo-Arabic, and if we are, although most of you in this room know me and know that I am a nut over the importance of the Hebrew language, and I like to study text in their original, but since the skills around this table, including mine, are very poor in Judeo-Arabic, I figured we may as well read it in the language that we understand better. But curiously, if I'm talking about the what's available on the net, people should know that a translation from about 3 or 4 years ago of the Moreh Nevuchim, the Guide of the Perplexed, into modern Hebrew is available, an excellent translation by Professor Michael Schwartz from Bar-Ilan University, directly from the Judeo-Arabic into the Hebrew of the 21st century, is available for free on the internet, and just sitting there. I found this out only after I spent $80 to get a copy of it within hard covers. So it goes these days. Rambam writes, this is right at the end of the Guide of the Perplexed, after he has done a after he's gone through most of the laws of the Torah and explained his approach to Ta'ameh Mitzvot, to understanding what the reasons were for these laws. Most of the statutes, the chukim, the reason of which is unknown to us, serve as a fence against idolatry. There are many chukim where I have not explained to you the idea behind it, but I know that they are a fence against idolatry. That I cannot explain some details of the above laws or show their use is owing to the fact that what we hear from others is not so clear as what we see with our own eyes. That which a human being experiences himself or herself is much stronger and clearer and more understandable than that which you read about in books. I, Rambam, have never experienced the Avodah Zarah that existed in the days that the Torah was written. I don't know anything about it except what I read in books. If I had been alive in that period and I knew what the world of Avodah Zarah was like, then I would understand the Torah better. Thus, my knowledge of the Sabian doctrines, that's what he calls the doctrines of the people who worshipped idols back then, which I derived from books, is not as complete as the knowledge of those who have witnessed the public practice of those idolatrous customs, especially as they have been out of practice and entirely extinct since 2,000 years. For 2,000 years, nobody has worshipped the kind of Avodah Zarah that the Torah is polemicizing against. And if you just realize that the Torah is polemicizing against a problem that hasn't existed for 2,000 years, then when you say to yourself, well, I don't understand this rule in the Torah, well, that's because you don't know what they're talking about. They're talking about a world that no longer exists. For 2,000 years, the Rambam says, we would say now for 3,000 years, that kind of Avodah Zarah doesn't exist. And the reason that we don't understand some laws of the Torah is because they are a polemic against an argument against the Avodah Zarah that doesn't exist anymore. If we knew all the particulars of the Sabian worship and were informed of all the details of those doctrines, we would clearly see the reason and wisdom of every detail in the sacrificial service, in the laws concerning things that are unclean, and in other laws, the object of which I am unable to state. A lot of mitzvot, I can't explain to you what the purpose is, but I promise you, the Rambam said, if we had been alive in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, we'd understand these laws. They're perfectly understandable, and they were created to fight against a situation that existed back then, and that we don't understand, and we don't know anything about now. Yes?
Question. So does that mean that the whole concept of chukim did not exist during the time of Matan Torah?
Okay, so Rambam says that there is no such thing as chukim in the way that people commonly understand chukim. A lot of people understand chukim as rules that have no reason. Rambam says there is no such thing as a rule that has no reason. There are rules, the reasons of which we do not understand. But they do have reasons. So it's a perceptual problem as opposed to a factual problem. Every rule does have a reason. There's no question about that in the Rambam's system. And he talks about people who think that it makes it better, that it's better to say that the law doesn't have a reason. It makes it more holy. It makes it more godly. If it has a reason, he says, I've met people who say, if the Torah's laws have reasons, then they're comparable to human laws. But the fact that there are no reasons to the laws are proof of the divinity of these laws. He says, I've heard people saying that. And he says, these are sick people. And I'm going to explain to you what the sickness is that they feel in their soul. They think that human beings are rational and that God is irrational. And that's, and you know, this insult about God, that only human beings act rationally and do things because of reasons, and God does things because God is not is irrational. He said this is the greatest insult to God to say something like this. So everything has a reason, according to the Rambam. It's just we don't know them. And why don't we know them? Because we don't understand Avodah Zarah enough. And why don't we understand Avodah Zarah enough? Because it's been gone for 2,000 years. Yes?
If there's a whole bunch of laws that change the situation that we can't understand because it no longer exists, are these laws now obsolete?
Ah. Okay, so that's, you know, as I said in my introduction, I knew that that is where we are obviously in our mind going to be going, and I'm willing to deal with that, and maybe I'll be willing to deal with that in the end. Maybe I'll just tell you, like, I think the first time that I ever taught this text in a public setting was a little more than 20 years ago. I think it was Rabbi Benji Hecht's outfit, Nishma, had invited me to speak to some outfit had invited me to speak on some Saturday night for some university students, and I was teaching this text, and we were talking about the implications of this text, and there was this very smart young university student who kept asking that question that you just asked, and kept asking it in different ways and with different understandings, and I felt that I did a poor job of dealing with his questions. He went on to become my colleague at York University as Professor Eric Lowy of this young university. So now he teaches this text. I have to ask Eric, how he teaches this this text, right?
Yeah, and the Rambam himself, more than all the Rishonim, is the one who emphasizes the divine authorship of the Bible,
right,
the unchanged nature. So it's very interesting. The same Rambam mentions more than anybody else that anybody believes one letter is not seen on the number of the total of the
right.
forest.
Right.
So I don't wonder if there's,
right.
know.
Right. Very good. Okay, we will get to that. So I just want to talk about the kind of historical approach first, and then we'll see what we're going to do with this. Okay, again, in the middle of this paragraph, I have no doubt that all these laws serve to blot out wrong principles from man's heart and to exterminate the practices which are useless and merely a waste of time and vain and purposeless things. The Torah came to wean people away from Avodah Zarah, to separate people from Avodah Zarah, because Avodah Zarah was an awful kind of thing. And so all the laws of these the Torah were to get us away from a problem that you and I don't have. And you know, and that's the shocking. You know, that's you know, we're sitting here shaking, thinking to ourselves, does this undermine the authority of the law? Those principles have turned the mind of the people away from intellectual research and useful actions. That's what's bad about Avodah Zarah. It gets you involved in something that's that human beings should not be involved in. Consider. Yes, there are lots of things, right? Very good. That's right. Maybe we need a new set of laws to get us away from the various evil things in our society.
Not even using the word evil,
useless and, yes, very good. That's right. Yes, what are those things that keep us away from intellectual pursuits? Pardon me?
Television.
Yes. I was going to say NFL football. You know, various things on which I waste my time instead of dealing with intellectual pursuits. Like, you know, okay. Consider how great the evil consequences of idolatry are and say whether we ought with all our power to oppose it or not. Of course people should be against Avodah Zarah. Except he keeps saying that it doesn't exist anymore, really, at least the kind that existed in the days of Moshe. Most of the precepts serve, as has been stated by us, as a mere fence against those doctrines of idolatry and relieve man from the great and heavy burdens, from the pains and afflictions which form part of the worship of idols. Every positive or negative precept, the reason of which is unknown to you, anytime you read a rule in the Torah and you can't figure out where that rule came from, take as a remedy, assume that it is a remedy against some of those diseases with which we are unacquainted at present, Baruch Hashem. Thank God, we don't know about this kind of Avodah Zarah, and the Torah is there to try to wean us away from this kind of Avodah Zarah that we know nothing about, Baruch Hashem. This should be the belief of educated men, and if Rambam were living today, I would hope he would say, and women. So, this is what you should think about the Torah. This is amazing. This is not about Abai or Rav, as I said. This is about the Kadosh Baruch Hu and Moshe Rabbeinu, that when they gave laws, they were related to a specific historical kind of situation. And the next text from the Moreh Nevuchim is just one example. It's one of my favorite examples from the Rambam, because it really, on the one hand, it shows the brilliance of the Rambam, and then it also shows other things. Meat boiled in milk. Why do we have why does the Torah say that you're not allowed to boil meat in milk? It's undoubtedly gross food. When Friedlander used the word gross in 1919, I don't think he was using the word gross the way my children use the word gross. I think he was using the word gross as meaning very heavy. That's a, yes, it's very heavy food. And remember, everybody remembers the Rambam was a physician, and you know he had lots of opinions about diet, about what people should be eating and shouldn't be eating. It's a very heavy food and makes over full. It's one of the reasons for not eating meat and milk is because you'll become too full if you eat it. But I think that most probably it is also prohibited because it is somehow connected with idolatry, forming perhaps part of the service or being used on some festival of the heathen. You want to know what I think, says Rambam? I'm guessing that the idolaters used to boil meat in milk, used to boil a kid in its mother's milk at one of their idolatry festivals, and that's why the Torah says, Lo tevashel gedi b'chalev imo, it means don't do what the idolaters did 2,000 years before him, 3,000 years before us. I find support for this view in the circumstance that the law mentions the prohibition twice after the commandment giving concerning the festivals. Three times in the year, all your males shall appear before the Lord your God, as if to say, when you come before me on your festivals, do not seethe your food in the manner as the heathen used to do. In fact, the verse says, twice in the Torah it says precisely the same language, Reshit bikurei admatcha tavi beit Hashem Elokecha, you should bring the first fruits of your land to the temple of the Lord your God, and then, Lo tevashel gedi b'chalev imo, don't boil a kid in his mother's milk.
This translation goes beyond that. Meat boiled in milk goes beyond Al tevashel gedi b'chalev
yes.
imo. He's taken it the next step.
He has taken it the next
step. That it says that.
Right.
Meat boiled in milk.
Yes, it doesn't. You're absolutely right. It does not say meat boiled in milk. Pardon me? So.
He's sort of been taking the interpretation that we understand of Al Tevashel Gedi B'Chalev Imo as meat
boiled. The halachic interpretation of it.
And yet he's saying it says it near the parts about idolatry, but it doesn't say meat boiled in milk. It says don't.
It says specifically a kid boiled in its mother's milk. Which
that's what they said. That was the
Avodah Zarah,
the ancients.
That's right. Pardon me? Dabka Gedi. That's right.
That's what some of them, or even the Rambam, try to explain.
Right.
So I would
that's right.
That's why the Torah said
Rosabash. Right. Yes, he is stretching, but you're absolutely right. He is stretching. I'll get back to that in 1 second. This, I consider, is the best reason for the prohibition, but as far as I have seen the books on Sabian rites, nothing is mentioned of this custom. He says, you know, I went to the library and I took out every book that I could find about Avodah Zarah in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, and Rambam was a true scholar and really did this kind of research. There is the unfortunate fact that he found one book which he relied on a lot, which claimed to have been written 2,000 years before him, but it was a forgery. It was a book called The Nabataean Agriculture, which he quotes very often, and unfortunately it was found to be a medieval forgery. But, you know, his scholarly method was, I think, the ideal kind of historical critical scholarly method. I've got a book. It was written 2,000 years ago. I don't understand some things in that book. If I could just understand the society from which that book came, then I would understand what's written in that book. And, you know, this goes against the concept of the eternal Torah. You know, the Torah is talking to you and me the same way that it was talking to the Jew who lived in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu. He says, no, it's a historical document that comes from a particular period in history that related to particular events, the particular problems, particular situations that existed in that time. And just the sense of the Rambam. So he looks at this pasuk. He looks at this verse and he can't figure it out. Why does the verse say, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk? And he said it must have been polemicizing against Avodah Zarah that existed in those days. And as Rabbi Kelman hinted before, we now know that the Rambam took a very good guess, and he was right. He says, I looked and I couldn't find any sources that idolaters did this, but it just seems to me, his sense as a reader of the text, there must have been a situation in that time that it was polemicizing against. So Cyrus Gordon, who was one of the first scholars who studied a text from a place called Ugarit. Ugarit was a city-state. It is near the modern city of Latakia in the Syria-Lebanon area. Latakia used to be called Ugarit, and there was a culture in Ugarit of Baal worshippers who lived in Ugarit and who wrote texts of a religious nature in Ugarit before the days of the Torah, like from 3,500 years ago or more, in a language that is extremely similar to Hebrew, and in a style that is extremely similar to Hebrew. Even the nature of biblical poetry, I'm sure all of you know, is based on the principle of parallelism. You say something once, and then you say it again. B'tzeit Yisrael mi'mitzrayim, Beit Yaakov me'am lo'ez, Haitai Yehudah l'kodesho, Yisrael mam shelotav. Some jokers say that if you want to be a biblical Hebrew poet, the first book that you had to buy was a thesaurus, because you had to be able to say something once, and then you have to be able to say it a second time. And Ugaritic poetry is the same kind of poetry. This is not a common style of poetry, but before the days of the Bible, Ugaritic poetry was used, written the same kind of style, and even some scholars have even shown that Ugaritic poetry, some of the pairs that are used, like Yom Valaila, very often you'll find in a line of poetry that Yom will appear in the first line and Laila will appear in the second half of the line. It's the parallel words to each other to try to say all the time, I do this in the day, I do it at the night. These kinds of pairs, scholars have found 40 pairs of words that are commonly used in both sides of the line in Hebrew and were commonly used in Ugaritic, very similar language. So Cyrus Gordon published a text, a little more than 50 years ago, in which he found that in Ugarit they had a first fruit festival where they used to bring the first fruits to the temple of Baal, and as part of the first fruit festival they used to boil a kid in its mother's milk. And he said, gee, the Rambam, without having the benefit of the archaeological finds in Ugarit, and without being able to read these Ugaritic texts, he simply had the sense. He's looking at the text here. He's saying the text has to be polemicizing against something that must have existed back then. And I, Professor Cyrus Gordon, I have found that which the biblical text was polemicizing against. The Rambam says, I've been looking for it. I can't find it. Not in the library here in Alexandria. I can't find any proof that this was going on, but he understands historical method. This is what you do. Yes?
It's interesting that we can bring first fruit then. In fact, we're commanded.
Ah, that's right. That's right. Okay. So that is an interesting way. We are, there are some things that the idolaters do that we, that we're, yes, yes, yes. Well, certainly we are not allowed to bring our first fruit to the temple of Baal. That is not permitted. Pardon me?
Batuaronga.
That's right. Yes.
Aren't those also written together? One those.
Yes.
Shale, that's what it
yes. Yes. And yes. Okay. So now to try to get to the question that you were pushing towards, and that Eric Lowy, many years ago, before he was Professor Eric Lowy, was pushing towards. Just to point out, of course, everybody here knows, I'm sure, that Rambam codified the rules of Basar B'Chalav at great detail in the Mishneh Torah. He did not feel that the fact, even though this is his historical critical method, we can still ask the question, what is the mindset of saying that these rules remain in force? But obviously the Rambam does not feel that the historical critical method of the study of the Torah, of saying that the Torah is relating to a specific historical situation, leads to saying, so today we don't have to observe these rules of Basar B'Chalav, because obviously the Rambam dedicated much of his life to understanding, teaching, and codifying these rules. So, on some level, I would argue that there are many things in society that are sometimes relics of a previous period in history, and that people infuse new meaning into them. Not only in Canada, but also in the United States, which is not a monarchy, there is there's a House. And there's a Senate. There's a bicameral system. Anybody who's studied any history knows, why is there a bicameral system? Where did the bicameral system come from? Why is there such a thing as a Senate? Why don't you have just one house of legislators? In Israel, they have one house of legislators, and that's how legislation gets passed. And some people say that the system doesn't work very well. But what is the reason that Canada and the United States have a bicameral system, historically speaking? I think it's because England had a bicameral system. And why did England have a bicameral system? Because the commoners should not be allowed to decide things on their own. That when the House of Commons was created, commoners are going to be deciding legislation. It's unthinkable that the commoners ought to be allowed to decide things on their own. There has to be a House of Lords. There has to be a House of the landed gentry who will make sure that the commoners do not decide things in a way that will go against the interest of the landed gentry. That's where my understanding of history, that's where the bicameral system came from. And in Canada and the United States, we have preserved the bicameral system. We have attempted, perhaps in Canada without a lot of success, we have attempted to infuse new meaning into something like this. But when you're part of a traditional society, you don't just get rid of something that exists beforehand. And, you know, there are various reasons for observing a law that might not necessarily be connected to the original reason for the law, like belonging to a community, being part of a faith group, everybody making Shabbos for himself, not everybody just deciding, I'm going to live a moral life on my own, but I want to be part of a community of people who live a moral life. And that's why I observe the rules of Basar B'Chalav. But I'm willing to accept the Rambam's argument and Cyrus Gordon's argument that the rules about Basar B'Chalav came from a polemic against a form of idolatry that hasn't existed for 3,000 years. And I still, you know, I throw away pots from my kitchen if something gets traced up by mistake, because I've infused new meaning into this. But it's possible to look at the historical critical approach as Rambam did without throwing out the system. Yes.
But as time goes on and new situations come up, there's new halakha. But doesn't that not mean that when we don't get rid of, in theory, what is no longer necessary, that we're bogging down the
Yes, doesn't the system get clogged up with all sorts of things? Very good.
Based on this, are meaningless.
Right.
This might be harmless. So I don't eat meat and milk together. I'm used to it. What's the big deal? What does it have to do with relationships between people? And it no longer, not only is it's traditional, whatever it can be, maybe even considered harmful.
Yes. I think that I will try to answer that question in about half an hour after we learn together a couple more texts, but that's precisely the question towards which I am aiming to get. But I don't want to answer it yet until we learn a little more. Yes?
But there's another notion here, which is that humanity, or we as people, are on some kind of trajectory where you started at a point where you had this kind of idolatry, and the Torah has put in laws and things to get you away from that. And so this may be part of what got you away from it. So you're not going to let go of it with the risk of going back to something.
That's an interesting perspective, that we owe a debt to the rules of Basar B'Chalav, to the rules of meat and milk, because they have helped us along. Yes, and give us up. Because of the possible danger of sliding back. Very interesting idea. Okay. I just threw in here for the fun of it one of my favorite 19th century texts at the bottom of this first page here, without an English translation. Sorry, I didn't provide an English translation here. Shmuel David Luzzatto, Samuel David Luzzatto, a rabbi in England from 1800 to 1865, taught at the Orthodox Rabbinical Seminary in Padua, and was a great opponent of Reform Judaism. But a lot of people say, and you'll see from this text here, that he was a very modern kind of guy from his thinking perspective. Well, we'll talk about the text after we read it. Chazal begins by quoting a Rashbam, a comment of Rashbam, where Rashbam says that the rabbis akru, chachamim akru et hakatuv mipshuto. The rabbis uprooted the verse from its simple meaning. They took a biblical text. He's referring to a specific verse in Vayikra Zayin Yudchet. Anybody who's interested, it's a detail in the rules of Korbanot. Don't want to go into it here, but you can look up the text and you can look up Rashbam. Rashbam says, you know, what the rabbis did with this, it has nothing to do with the contextual interpretation of the text at all. And he just leaves it that way. He says, Chachamim akruhu mipshuto. The rabbis gave an entirely non-contextual interpretation of this verse. So Shadal says, Acharei kama shanim shayiti matmiya al razal. You know, it's been a lot of years I've been wondering about the rabbis, the Talmudic rabbis. Lama kedivrei Rashbam akru hakatuv hazeh mipshuto. I've been wondering, you know, Rashbam is right. Here's what the verse says, and here's what the rabbis say, and they have nothing to do with each other. So why did the rabbis do that? I've been wondering about that for years. Hayom, Purim, Taf Resh Zayin. Today, Purim, 1847. You see what Shadal did on Purim. He sat there worrying about Parshat Tzav, about Vayikra chapter 7, trying to understand how these things worked. Zachiti lahavin mara'u al-kacha, a little allusion to a line from the Megillah. So he was in shul, and he heard the line from the mara'u al-kacha al-mahigia al-him. Now, finally, I understand what motivated the rabbis. V'chein v'chol makom shenatu razal mipshat haktuvim k'she'in hadavar dad yachid aval hu davar muskam b'li cholek einenu ta'ut sheta'u aval hu takana shetiknu l'fi tzorech hadorot umi kamohem reformator. He says, whenever the rabbis came up with a new interpretation that went against the simple meaning of the biblical text, and he says, I don't mean that just one rabbi did, but that all the rabbis bought into this. Why were they doing it? Because they saw that that's what their generation needed. And a hora'atcha, that, you know, rabbis look at their community and they look at what the needs of the community are, and he said there were no reformers greater than the rabbis of the Mishnah and the Talmud. Shadal, who is this big opponent of 19th century Reform Judaism, he says, you want to know who the true reformers are? Who the true Reform Jews, the real Reform Jews were? It was Chazal. And they did it well. Aval takanotehem, 3, hayu b'chachma amuka, ובירת השם ואהבת אדם, לא להנעת עצמם או לכבודם, ולא למצוחין בעיני בשר ודם. But they did it because they loved God and they loved human beings. And they didn't do it in order to ingratiate themselves with the Gentiles, which is what he was generally wrote in his writings about Reform Judaism, that the reforms of Judaism were being done for Jews to be able to ingratiate themselves in German society and just become part of the society. So this is maybe, it's very difficult to find any other Orthodox person in history who says it quite as clearly as this, as Shadal, who says, that rabbis, the job of rabbis are to look at the needs of their community. This comes very close to Blue Greenberg, in fact, of saying when there is a rabbinic will, there is a halachic way. That if the rabbis look and they see that this is what their generation needs, then they do it. And that is what the rabbis did, and that's the only way that we can understand the gigantic gap that exists between the simple meaning of the biblical text and what it says in the Talmud, is by doing this. Okay, I'd like to go on now and read one medieval Jewish text, a responsum. Maybe I'll just mention one point before I go on. I'll give you a couple of examples from, you know, Shabbat rules that we all observe Shabbat candles. Why are Shabbat candles such a big mitzvah? there are all sorts of explanations that are given, and you know, I don't like to deflate any explanations about it, but it's probably the reason that Shabbat candles are such a big mitzvah is because it's a polemic against Karaite Judaism. And it started to become a really important mitzvah in the days when there were Karaites who said that you had to sit in the dark, and so the way of showing that you're not a Karaite is to light Shabbat candles. Now, you know, sometimes I hesitate to say this, especially to little kids, so, you know, being told about the aura of light in the house, and all, you know, there are some beautiful ideas that can be associated. Is it really terrible to realize that at one point it served a particular historical purpose and that now serves another purpose in our house? I don't think that it's that terrible.
What's the Talmudic reason shown by it?
Shalom, yeah, okay, right. But you can see that, you know, the discussion of brachot, it grew in the Middle Ages, it grew in importance, it grew in halachot about it in the Middle Ages. Cholent, the idea of having warm food on Shabbat was also a polemic against the Karaites. One medieval rabbi, if I remember correctly, was the Bala Maori, has a little ditty, a little doggerel poem, Kol mi eino ochel chamin choshashin shehu min. If you don't eat chamin, you don't eat cholent, we assume that, halachically speaking, I don't think those of you who don't like machal av, you know, a heavy food, as the Rambam said before, somebody once told me you can fulfill this mitzvah by having a glass of tea. It's just the idea showing that you feel that it is permissible during Shabbat day to have warm food, because the Karaites said that it is forbidden to have warm food. So, you know, we know this. And still, I like the idea. I do try, you know, even if I'm someplace where there is no warm food on Shabbat, I like the idea that of having something warm, and I know there aren't any Karaites in my life, and I don't have to be polemicizing against them, but I still think it's a nice thing to do. Of course, the question is, what happens when, as you said before, what happens when it's not something, you know, parva like okay, very good. Okay, well, we'll give you another example now. I have here a response from Rav Yosef Bar of Sheshet in Spain in the 14th century. You have it in Hebrew and English. The English is my translation, and it's shortened, and I just left I left out some of the parts in the English translation. I'll read it through in Hebrew. Those of you who are having trouble with the Hebrew can follow it in my English translation. I want to read through it quickly, and then I want to talk about it. L'dayane umanhige kahal tunis, I think it is, yishmarim tsurim v'yachayim melitzai re'ai. Here, To the judges in Tunis, God bless you. Here's what I have to say to you. Ra'iti she'elatchem. I saw your question. Al davar ha'ish an Samuel Arama. I saw your question about Samuel Arama. Sheratza lisaz kena achat batishim shana o yoter. It's a guy in your community who wanted to marry a woman who was 90 years old or older. Vehi almanat a Bonfus Farage mi Valencia. It's a widow of this Boniface Farage who came from Valencia there to Tunis. This guy wanted to marry her.
How old was the guy that wanted to marry
her? We will see from the continuation that he was rather young. Vahakahal michu biyado. And the Jewish community wouldn't let him marry this widow. Just like to give you a little footnote. The first place that I saw this tshuva was, I'll give you credit where credit is due, Professor Mark Washovsky, who teaches rabbinics at the Hebrew Union College, wrote an article one time where this was the central piece of his article. Professor Washovsky knows a lot about rabbinic Judaism. Not quite sure I want to use the word Talmid Chacham about him, but he's a great scholar of rabbinic Judaism. I think my conclusions about this tshuva might not be identical with Professor Wachowski's, but it's a tshuva from which a lot can be learned. Aside from the fact that it's an interesting kind of situation here. We've got this young guy who wants to marry this 90-year-old woman. Community won't let him do it. Lo nat nu reshut lisa'ena, lefisha eino nosa l'shem nisuim el ashanatan einav v'mamon. He wasn't marrying her because he wanted to be married to her. She had a lot of money. He has kenah hanisteret yeshla kamo shmonim kulot shel zahav. Va'od she'ein lo banim. This guy, he's got no children. She's got 80 doubloons of gold. And instead of marrying some woman where he could produce children, he says, I'm going to marry this 90-year-old woman and I'm going to have 80 doubloons of gold. And the Jewish community wouldn't let him do it. Van Samuel had nizkar hitiach dvarim keneged dayan uktzat bnei hakahal. He started screaming at the dayan who wouldn't let him get married, and against the community that wouldn't let him get married. Ad shahalach ladon ha'ir va'amar lo adoni. He went dragging in the non-Jewish authorities into the discussion here. He went to the guy in town, in charge of the town here in Tunis. Va'amar lo adoni. Elu ha-Yehudim mena'uni milisa isha. Weird Jews here in Tunis won't let me marry the woman that I'm in love with. Eini yodea alma va'alma. I have no idea why they won't let me marry this woman. Raksha ta'anu lefishi iskena lo tinase. They say, she's so old, she shouldn't get married. Ein zem mechok Hashem yitbarach. That's not part of God's law. That you can't marry this woman just because she's old. Beino midin toratenu. It's not part of the Torah. Ela kolor otzel liton kamo she yistamein katan lizkena zaken liktana kachu minhagenu b'chol ir v'ir. He came and said, I never heard of a Jewish community worrying about the relative ages of the bride and the groom. If an old man wants to marry a young woman or a young man wants to marry an old woman, Jewish communities don't stop people like this from doing what they want to do. Why, these Jews here in Tunis are driving me crazy and they're stopping me from marrying this woman. V'atem hishavtem ladona ir ki lo yeaseh ken b'Yisrael ad shelo kiyem pireya v'rivya. You said to the mayor of the town, actually, we have a law that a man is obligated to produce children. And if he's marrying this woman, he's not going to be producing children. And so that's why we stopped him from marrying this woman. Behu odenu machazik, but he's stuck with it. He's sticking to his guns. He's not giving up on his argument. Vehiskamtem im adon ha'ir. Fascinating historically. The Jewish community of Tunis has been called in by the mayor, the non-Jewish mayor of town, to defend itself against this disgruntled guy who says, they won't let me get married. And they talk it out, and they agree, the mayor agrees with the Jewish community leaders that they're going to send a letter to the great rabbi of Spain in these days, Rabbi Yitzchak Rav Sheshet, and let him rule on the subject. Hiskamtem im adon ha'ir lichtov elai. I am here to adjudicate between the Jewish community on the one side and this guy Samuel and the non-Jewish mayor on the other side. She'odia lachem da'ati bazeh lefi adin zoti she'elatchem. This is your question. Does anybody want to jump in before we see what Rav Yitzchak or Rav Sheshet has to say on the subject? Do anybody want to say anything about this situation? Pardon me? So what, if there's no shaila, which way? It's obviously asur, or it's obviously mutar? Obviously asur. Okay, that's what he's going to say in a second. Okay.
Anybody opens up anything, the first call in the mitzvah peru is yasur, so that's kids.
Rabbi Kelman is definitely right, but there is a but, and we will get to the but.
We don't do that anymore.
We don't do that anymore. Okay, so Rabbi Kelman has said two things here. A, it is usur, and B, we don't do it anymore. Okay, so let's read a little bit.
We don't do it anymore, I recall, is only if you marry a young person who can have kids. So the Shulchan Aruch questions, as we all know, after 10 years, if it's the woman's fault, and that we... you're obligated to divorce your wife. That's what it says.
Right.
So that's against quota priya. It's not nice today. For all kinds of reasons, we don't observe that halacha anymore today.
Okay.
That allow you to marry a woman who has a...
Hold on, because I haven't given you the whole tshuva. I'm now admitting. I only gave you part of the text. And I will give out to you at the end the second part of the text. I want us to discuss it after having not seen the entire text, and so we will see very soon. Yes,
was
very
good.
Yes, Marty.
Pardon
me? No, it is not a red herring, and we will see as we read on that the wealth is not a red herring. Marty, yes.
But are you also saying that today that a 60-year-old man who possibly had children couldn't get, and who's never had children, couldn't marry a 60-year-old woman?
Yeah.
You wouldn't marry them?
Are you asking me?
No, anybody in the world.
I'm not saying that. Right, the question is where do you draw the line?
Right.
A 60-year-old man has never had kids. Maybe there's some people it's not appropriate for them to have kids anymore. But we're talking. I wouldn't say that by 60-year-old, but a 25-year-old man who was there.
Right. Very good. Okay.
The real issue here is what happens is if somebody goes ahead and marries this woman, convinces her and marries her, does the community have a right to undo the marriage?
Right. Okay. We'll talk about that too. That will come up too. Yes, Abe.